Welcome back to part two. In our last study, we closed with trying to emphasize this history that covers the time when pagan Rome succumbed to papal Rome. We find this history recorded in prophecy, purposely recorded in prophecy in Daniel, in the relationship between the daily and the abomination of desolation, and in Revelation, and in the spirit of prophecy. We want to start this presentation with another passage from the spirit of prophecy, where she's once again emphasizing this transition and some of the issues connected with it. And this is from The Great Controversy, page 49 and 50. The Apostle Paul, in his second letter to the Thessalonians, foretold the great apostasy which would result in the establishment of the papal power. He declared that the day of Christ should not come except there come a falling away first, and the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalted himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he, as God, sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And furthermore, the apostle warns his brethren that the mystery of iniquity doth already work, 2 Thessalonians 2, 3, 4, and 7. Even at that early date, he saw, creeping into the church, errors that would prepare the way for the development of the papacy. Little by little, at first in stealth and silence, and then more openly, as it increased in strength and gained control of the minds of men, the mystery of iniquity carried forward its deceptive and blasphemous work. Almost imperceptibly, the customs of heathenism found their way into the Christian church. The spirit of compromise and conformity was restrained for a time by the fierce persecutions which the church endured under paganism. But as the persecution ceased and Christianity entered the courts and palaces of kings, she laid aside the humble simplicity of Christ and his apostles for the pomp and pride of pagan priests and rulers, and in place of the requirements of God, she substituted human theories and traditions. The nominal conversion of Constantine in the early part of the 4th century caused great rejoicing, and the world, cloaked with a form of righteousness, walked into the church. Now the work of corruption rapidly progressed. Paganism, while appearing to be vanquished, became the conqueror. Her spirit controlled the church. Her doctrines, ceremonies, and superstitions were incorporated into the faith and worship of the professed followers of Christ. This compromise between paganism and Christianity resulted in the development of the man of sin foretold in prophecy as opposing and exalting himself above God. That gigantic system of false religion is a masterpiece of Satan's power, a monument of his efforts to seat himself upon the throne to rule the earth according to his will. Now, Great Controversy, page 49 and 50. What we're wanting you to see there, hopefully, is that the history that the daily represents in relationship to the abomination of desolation is full of information about what's going to transpire here at the end of the world. The reason that we're taking this time as a follow-up series in connection with the presentation of Daniel 11 verses 40 to 45 is we are suggesting that when Sister White points, as we looked at in our last presentation, to verses 30 to 36 of Daniel 11 as a pattern for the final fulfillment of Daniel 11, what she is identifying as a pattern is clearly understood by her and the pioneers. That history of verse 30 to 36, if you take the works of the pioneers that address those verses, and you can find it very, very clearly set forth in this book by Daniel or by Uriah Smith, Daniel and Revelation. This history is the transition of pagan Rome to papal Rome in verses 30 to 36. And much of what took place there politically and religiously and the tactics that were used to bring in the compromise is nothing more than an object lesson for what we're going to experience at the end of the world. And when we go back into that history, we find that the pioneers very clearly understood that the one historical figure during that time period that marked the beginning of when paganism began to turn its efforts towards supporting the papacy was when Clovis, the king of France, a pagan monarch, professedly turned to Catholicism. And for the first time, a power that prior to that had been opposed to Catholicism. The power of France, Clovis, professes to be a Catholic, and it begins a work that ultimately will lead to the setting up of the papacy for the 1206-year time period. And you go back into history, and the historians will point to Clovis as the beginning of this work, and the essential work that has to be done in this historical sequence is the removal of the three horns of Daniel 7. The Ostrogoth, the Huli, and the Vandals were pagans as well as the other seven horns there in Daniel 7. They were all pagans, but these three horns, in their pagan belief structure, had one belief, Arianism, believing that Christ was a created being, that could not, would not, and did not coexist with Catholicism. And it couldn't just be incorporated into Catholicism. It had to be eliminated. And these three horns were military strengths as well as political and religious strengths, but they had to be removed. And in order to accomplish that, the papacy, not having a military strength of its own, has to use another military strength to do this. And the military support that comes to the papacy to accomplish the removal of these three horns, it begins to solidify for the papacy when Clovis professes to become a Catholic, and this took place in 496. And from this point on, the momentum grows till the historical marker for when the genuine battle to eliminate these three horns takes place is 508. And this is where the pioneers correctly marked the removing of the daily, the removing of paganism. Now, there's an understanding that we must have clearly here that when we're talking about paganism, the seven pagan nations of Europe coming to the aid of the papacy to remove these three Arian pagan horns, and when Daniel's describing that, he's talking about the daily taken away, paganism taken away. We must understand that it's taken away in the sense of profession. These nations of Europe still are going to be just as pagan in heart and action as they were before. They're simply going to profess to be Christians now. They're going to call themselves Catholics. But we know that Catholicism is nothing more than paganism with a Christian profession. So we're not seeing here illustrated that paganism is actually totally eliminated. It's just going to take another form. And the paganism that has to be removed is these three horns. And the other seven horns will remove their paganism by cloaking it with a profession of Catholicism. And if you go into the pioneer writings, and we're going to look at Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith here, to show that the pioneers understood this 508 time period. And this is just going to take a few brief selections out of this book. And we're going to begin with page 271 of Daniel and Revelation. As we approach the year 508, we behold a mighty crisis ripening between Catholicism and the pagan influences still existing in the empire. Up to the time of the conversion of Clovis, King of France, in AD 496, the French and other nations of Western Rome were pagan. But following that event, the efforts to convert idolaters to Romanism were crowned with great success. From the time when these successes were fully accomplished, in AD 508, the papacy was triumphant so far as paganism was concerned. For though the latter doubtless retarded the progress of the Catholic faith, yet it had not the power, if it had the disposition, to suppress the faith and hinder the encroachment of the Roman pontiff. When the prominent powers of Europe gave up their attachment to paganism, it was only to perpetuate its abominations in another form, for Christianity, as exhibited in the Roman Catholic Church, was and is only paganism baptized. We think it clear that the daily was taken away by 508. This was preparatory to the setting up or establishment of the papacy, which was a separate and subsequent event. Of this prophetic narrative now leads us to speak. they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. Having shown quite fully what we think constitutes the taking away of the daily, or paganism, we now inquire, when was the abomination that maketh desolate or the papacy placed or set up? The little horn that had eyes like the eyes of a man was not slow to see when the way was opened for his advancement and elevation. From the year 508, his progress towards universal supremacy was without parallel. And though that third horn was removed by 538. Now, today in Adventism, we no longer teach in our universities that the daily is paganism. We teach that it's identifying Christ's work in the sanctuary above, which is an incorrect view. And because we teach that, we certainly don't locate Christ's work in the sanctuary having any historical relationship with 508. And we've missed the significance of this history by doing that. But this history, one of the marker points for it was the profession, the conversion of Clovis to Catholicism in 496. And this is a history that is very important to Catholicism. This is the history that led to setting Catholicism on the throne of the earth. And this history is understood by Catholicism, even if Adventism no longer understands it. This is an important history for them. This is what brought them to power. And in 1996, last year, we came to the 1500th year since Clovis supposedly converted to Catholicism. And the Roman Catholic Church marked this event with a big celebration. And we're going to read an article out of the National Catholic Register from September of 1996 that describes what went on in commemorating this event from Clovis. And it will add some of the history that we may not no longer understand as Adventists, but that we should. Because this is the history that is so important in the books of Daniel and Revelation and to Adventist prophetic understanding. And this is the history that's undermined by the false view of the daily. This is just some passages out of an article from September 8th, 1996, National Catholic Register. John Paul II is coming to France this month, his fifth visit here since becoming Pope in 1978, to celebrate the 15th centenary of the baptism of Clovis, the first Western Christian king and founder of the modern French nation. It was a result of that baptism, traditionally believed to have taken place in Reims in 496 AD, that France glories in the title of the eldest daughter of the Church. It was in Reims that Clovis, pagan leader of the Salian Franks, was baptized by Saint Remy, the Bishop of Reims, in the presence of all the king's nobles. He was to give to France, then still known as Gaul, its name, its capital, its first royal dynasty, the Merovingians, named after his grandfather Merovec, and its official faith. Some have suggested that Clovis' baptism also was the baptism of France. The king's baptism did, however, mark the first official recognition of Christianity in a country still dominated by paganism and Arianism, the early Christian heresy which denied the divinity of Christ. The history of France and of Europe, and indeed the history of the Catholic Church, would not have been the same if this baptism had not taken place. Celebrating Clovis' baptism endorses the traditionalist view that his conversion marked the actual founding of France. By celebrating the baptism of Clovis, the French Republic is unilaterally endorsing a certain Christian image of France, he wrote. To remember Clovis is to recall monarchic religions and the divine right of kings. Shortly after establishing himself as king, Clovis fell in love with and married Clotilda, a beautiful Burgundian princess who had been left a penniless orphan after the brutal murder of her parents by her wicked uncle, the King of Burgundy. A devout Catholic, Clotilda was to play a key role in her pagan husband's conversion to Christianity. According to tradition, Clovis' spiritual turning point came in 496 during the Battle of Tolbiac against the Alemanni, another invading Germanic tribe. When all appeared lost for the Franks, Clovis raised his eyes to heaven and cried, "God of Clotilda, if you will give me victory, I will become a Christian." The Alemanni turned and fled. Not long after this, during Clovis' baptism, a second miracle reportedly occurred. The baptizing priest, who had been sent to bring the holy oil to the baptistry, was unable to push his way back through the hordes of Clovis' Frankish warriors crowding around the cathedral. The situation was saved by the sudden arrival of a white dove, which was seen to descend with a holy vial, which it carefully placed in Clovis' hands. In the 25 years of his reign, Clovis managed to drive off the waves of barbarian invaders and greatly extended his realm's boundaries to the east and to the south, consolidating his power through an alliance with the church. That's something that needs to be noted. Now, speaking of dropping down a ways, it is not yet known whether French President Jacques Chirac, who will meet the Pope on his arrival in France on September 19th, will attend the anniversary celebration of Clovis' baptism 3 days later in Reims Cathedral. He may now consider it politically ill-advised, but there is little doubt that his illustrious predecessor and political mentor, Charles de Gaulle, would have gone. "For me," de Gaulle said, "the history of France begins with Clovis. My country is Christian, and I begin to count the history of France from the arrival of a Christian king bearing the name of the Franks." Millions of French Catholics would still agree. This history of the seven horns of the former Roman Empire, the seven pagan horns of Europe that will turn to Catholicism and remove those other three horns in order to place the papacy on the throne of the world, is a history that's well understood by Catholicism. It's the history that the pioneers understood to be represented in the testimony of Daniel through his use of the word daily and the abomination of desolation. And it's a history that is important for us who live at the end of the world to understand, because it sets a pattern for circumstances that are going to take place in our time. And as an example, this is a follow-up study to Daniel 11, 40 to 45. And in verse 40 of Daniel 11, we identify three powers. We identify the king of the south as atheism, beginning a war against the king of the north, Catholicism, in 1798, the time of the end. And we suggest that the influence that brought about the French Revolution and the influence that historians say placed Napoleon Bonaparte upon the throne of France was atheism, a philosophy that was nurtured and brought into France prior to the French Revolution. And that philosophy inspired Napoleon to take the Pope captive, thus delivering the deadly wound and beginning a war between the philosophy of atheism and Catholicism. And this philosophical battle and war continues in verse 40 of Daniel 11 until in our day there is an alliance that's illustrated between the King of the North, Catholicism, and another power, which is symbolized by chariots, ships, and horsemen, which in a more in-depth study we identify as the United States. The chariots and ships and horsemen identifying military and economic strength, and thus identifying the characteristics of the second beast of Revelation 13, the United States, the lamb-like beast that's going to force the whole world to worship the beast of Catholicism, and the force that it brings to the world to worship the beast is military and economic strength. You must receive the mark if you're going to buy or sell, and if you don't receive the mark, you're going to be put to death. So these two characteristics in Revelation 13 of the United States are symbolized in verse 40 of Daniel 11 in the chariots and ships and horsemen. And when we take this passage that Sister White points to, verses 30 to 36, where our opening consideration of this study, and Sister White says, "Scenes similar to these will take place," that history of verse 30 to 36 And if you're not familiar with that history, go back to the pioneer writings. Go back to Daniel and Revelation. That history is describing this transition time of Clovis and onward until the papacy begins its 1260 years of ruling the earth in 538. And we see illustrated in Clovis a power that had formerly been opposed to Catholicism. The pagan powers of Europe were the powers that prior to the time of Clovis were throwing Christians to the lions. And even though I'm hesitant to use call Catholicism Christian, because I do not believe it is, at least historically, Catholicism is identified by historians as a branch of Christianity. But paganism was not only opposed to true Christianity, it was opposed to Catholicism. And it had been its worst opposer. Clovis, in that sense, represented an opposing, an opposition to Catholicism, and yet he converts to Catholicism. And with his conversion marks the beginning of these other pagan powers coming into agreement with him, and they begin to work to place papalism on the throne of the earth. And in verse 40 of Daniel 11, when Sister White points to this history and says scenes similar to these will take place, in verse 40, when you identify the second beast of Revelation 13, the lamb-like beast, the United States, as represented by the symbols of chariots and ships and horsemen in verse 40 of Daniel 11, what you're doing is you're identifying a power, Protestant America, that has formally been opposed to Catholicism, Protestantism. If there's a power in the world today that opposes Catholicism most, it's certainly Protestantism. And prior to the time period that the United States formed a secret alliance with the Vatican in the Reagan years, in the early 1980s, certainly the most prominent Protestant force in the world was the United States. It had opposed Catholicism, and you drop back into the history of the United States, 50, 75 years. I mean, it was a strong opposition to Catholicism. Here we see a modern-day Clovis. The United States, as the number one Protestant force in the world, suddenly turns away from its Protestant position and forms a secret alliance with the Vatican in order to attack a mutual enemy, the Soviet Union, atheism. And this secret alliance is doing nothing more than repeating a history that's symbolized by Clovis, that's symbolized by the word daily. Now, the word daily, if we look to our board here, we'll see the three entities in John the Revelator's description of modern Babylon. Modern Babylon in Revelation 16 is called a great city, and it's divided into three parts. And earlier in Revelation 16, it says these three parts are the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. And what we're saying is, in the study of the daily and its relationship to the abomination of desolation, that this dragon power is paganism. Paganism that began at the Tower of Babel and continues on down to through history. And there comes a time in the history of paganism when it was destined to subside, but not cease. It was just going to give way to this second power that was going to oppose God and its people in history, and this is papalism. And we know that papalism begins prophetically in 538, even though it was existent in Bible time. We mark its time to reign in 538. So this history is describing the relationship of two powers. Paganism has been opposing God, His truth, His people since the Tower of Babel, and there comes a point in prophetic history where it's clear that paganism gives way, doesn't cease, just gets way, gives way, and works to allow papalism to come and rise to the throne of the earth. And this time period that papalism is going to dominate the earth and resist God and His truth and His people is 1260 years, and it comes to its end in 1798. And during this 1798 time period, we see a third transition take place, because we see the third power that goes to make up modern Babylon of Revelation 16. We see the false prophet begin its history. In 1776, the United States begins as a lamb-like beast, but it was destined to reach a point in history where it simply wasn't Protestant America. It becomes the false prophet. I would suggest to you that the word Protestant is a Christian word that identifies nothing more than to protest Rome. And when the United States formed a secret alliance in the early 1980s with the Vatican, that it ceased, at least politically, to be a Protestant nation any longer, because the definition is to protest Rome. And at that point, it becomes at least the beginning of being the false prophet. But here we see in Revelation 16, these three powers go together to make up the threefold union of modern Babylon. But this history, the transition from paganism to papalism, so much talked about in prophecy, is what Daniel is describing when he talks about the daily and the abomination of desolation. Now, brothers and sisters, the word daily is used in the sanctuary presentations in the Bible over and over, and because of that, the people that arrive at the false view of the daily get there by assuming that because Daniel chose the word continual, which is translated daily, that he must be referring to the sanctuary. But when you understand what the pioneers recognized that the daily symbolized, paganism, then you realize how perfect of a word it was for Daniel. Because as we look at modern Babylon, these three powers, the false prophet begins its rise to power in 1776. The beast of Catholicism begins to rule the earth in 538. All three of these powers, paganism, the beast, and the false prophet, exist at the end of the world. But there's only one of those powers that has been opposing God's people and his truth and him throughout history. It's paganism. It has continually been opposing God's people and its truth. When Daniel symbolizes paganism with the word continual, it's the perfect word, because paganism is the one power of the threefold union of modern Babylon that has continually been there. So understanding that is in agreement with how the pioneers came to understand what the daily symbolized in Daniel without challenging the word. The word is perfectly accurate. Now, this understanding of the pioneers existed in Adventism until the turn of the century. And in the turn of the century, a man named Conradi, who was an Adventist leader in Europe, began to once again reintroduce the old evangelical view of the daily, that this symbolized Christ's work in the sanctuary. And he was the only one that had that view. And if you consider who Conradi was, he was an apostate of no small caliber. If there is a lack of reverence for the work of Sister White in Europe today, most people trace that right back to Conradi's work that he did in Europe, because he undermined the spirit of prophecy the whole time that he worked there. And he isn't a man that you would look at the testimony of his work for the Lord and uphold in any fashion. And he began to promote this view that the daily wasn't as the pioneers understood it. And there was two leaders in the United States that accepted his position and began to promote it, Daniels and Prescott. Now, people that today get involved with this discussion about the daily, they go back to the writings of Sister White during that time period. And basically, her counsel was, I don't have any new information on the daily. She had already said that in early writings that the pioneer position was correct. But what she said more often than not is, let's just lay this discussion aside. It's only destined to bring in confusion and darkness. Now, you need to understand here that when she's given the counsel that here we have Daniels and Prescott that have a real burden, they're on fire to promote this new view of the daily, which in reality is only the old evangelical view of before the 1844 time period, but in her writings, she'll refer to it as the new view, Daniels and Prescott have this burden to promote this, and her counsel at that time about that discussion is, you know, silence is golden. Let's drop the subject. And here's what you need to consider. During that time period, it was just those two men that were trying to promote it. And she was saying, you know, let's drop the subject. So she wasn't endorsing them by saying, let's drop the subject. She was trying to, in a very Christ-like fashion, encourage these brethren to get off that position because it wasn't a work that was to be pursued. And she was hoping that everybody else that was being hit up about this new view by them would remember that she said, let's just drop the subject. But it didn't happen that way. They continued to promote this view and push for it. And it's interesting, as you go back through Adventist history and you look at the many well-known leaders that have apostatized and left the faith, that many of them, before they get all the way out or right at the beginning of their departing from the truth, they accept this new view that Daniels and Prescott are promoting, that the daily represents Christ's work in the sanctuary. And when you accept this view and you carry it through to its logical conclusion, it sweeps away William Miller and the pioneers' understanding of this history of paganism and papalism, and it begins to undermine the time prophecies that are the foundation of Adventism. And as it continues to be logically applied to the whole message of Adventism, it just destroys it. Now, most people, by far, that accept this false view, they do not carry it to its conclusion. They just think, well, the word continual, translated as daily, that's a sanctuary word, so that's what it's talking about, and they read through those passages, and they never do their homework to see what that does to prophecy. They move on and they forget about it. But some of the people that have accepted this false position in years past in Adventism have taken it to its full conclusion, and it was because they had accepted it and they took it to its full conclusion that they ultimately had to reject the Adventist message, because they realized that the Adventist message was incorrect because of what the daily does to the Adventist message if you understand it to be Christ's ministry in the sanctuary. Now, some of the people that have went out into darkness, that along the way or at the beginning of that walk into darkness in Adventism, that incorporated this false view of the daily are E.G. Wagner of 1888 fame. And he said this about this idea that when you carry it to its logical conclusion, it destroys Adventism. He says in a letter from November 22nd, 1909, early writings, the passage we read, most clearly and decidedly declares the old view. O.A. Johnson shows most clearly that the testimonies uphold the view taught by Smith. Now, what Wagner's saying here is that he no longer can accept the pioneer position. It's just not valid for him. He's accepted the new view, the false view, and that Ellen White endorses the false view. Now, what does that do? It doesn't just destroy your prophetic understanding of the Adventist message. It proves that Ellen White's a false prophet. And that's where Wagner got with this thing. But he knew, he could see, and some will tell you, well, Sister White doesn't take a position one way or another on the daily. But Wagner and others, and O.A. Johnson clearly identified this, that Sister White upholds the pioneer position. And this was a struggle that helped take Wagner out. Prescott, one of the two that were pushing this view at the beginning of the century, he eventually abandons the sanctuary doctrine. Jones takes the false view on the daily, and he apostatized completely. A.G. Daniels, we're going to talk about a little bit more in depth here in a second. Ballinger, if you've heard the history of Ballinger, that when he apostatized completely, he took the wrong position on the daily. Later than Ballinger, there's a man named Fletcher, Snide, Grieve, take the wrong position on the daily, leave the church. More recent history, Brimsmead ends up being in the church for a while with a message, but takes the wrong view on the daily, among other things, goes out. perhaps the most recent well-known apostate that has the false position on the daily is Ford. And he ends up going out. Now, brothers and sisters, by their fruits you shall know them. You go back in the list we just looked, are probably the most prominent apostates in Advent history since 1900. And one thing they have in common is their position on the daily. They take the false view in the daily. Now, another interesting thing is Sister White upheld the pioneer view until her death in 1915, but Daniels and others continued to push this false view until today. It's the view that's taught in our universities and printed in our books by our theologians. But it grew through history. And in 1945, when they wanted to rewrite portions of the book Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith, they wanted to rewrite the pioneer position on the daily out of it, because at that point in 1945, they had no use for that position. And so they went to work to try to remove Uriah Smith's position on the daily out of here, and they realized they couldn't do it. His presentation was so sound, and it was so interwoven to the whole story of the prophetic message of Daniel, that they couldn't take it out, and they had to leave it in there, even though they no longer agreed with it. That tells you something about the history of the argument. Now, we want to go back to A.G. Daniels. You see, A.G. Daniels came out in 1931 with a report, September 25th, 1931, that he had interviewed Ellen White in 1910 on the subject of the daily, and that she endorsed his false view of the daily, as she agreed with him. Now, that's been one of the key arguments about this false view being the view for Adventism to this very day, is that Daniels had interviewed her while she was still alive, and that she said, you know, he has the light on it. But during that time period, during the very year that Daniels points back to and says that he interviewed Ellen White, on June 8th of 1910, F.C. Gilbert interviewed Ellen White, and his interview, the White estate has recorded that he was there. Daniels said he interviewed with Ellen White, and yet you go back in the White estate and they have no record of an interview with Daniel. Now, F.C. Gilbert was a Hebrew scholar, and he didn't simply support the correct view of the daily, that it was paganism because the pioneers and Ellen White said it was. He could defend it from the Hebrew. He was the prominent a scholar during the 1900 to 1950 time period when this controversy continued to grow that Daniels and Prescott were pushing. He was the prominent scholar to defend the correct position against this false view coming in. And he had an interview with Ellen White on June 8th, 1910. And the day after his interview, he wrote down a brief summary of what him and Sister White had discussed. And he says that in his statements about what he had heard Ellen White say the day before, that she clearly said Daniels and Prescott's position on the daily was from the devil. I mean, that they were unconverted, they need to be reconverted. And he put that in paper the day after his interview, and it's clear by the Ellen White estate reports that he did have the interview. And yet, 21 years later, Daniels says he had an interview that year with Ellen White, which the White estate can't confirm. And Daniels' testimony is completely contrary to F.C. Gilbert's, completely opposes it. And we, as God's people, choose Daniel's testimony over the pioneers and F.C. Gilbert. And through history, Daniel's testimony is one of the pieces of the puzzle that allows us to come to this wrong conclusion at the end of the world. But when manuscript releases begin to be published, there comes out a letter written in the 1910 time period. And this is Manuscript Releases, Volume 20, pages 17 to 22. Where Sister White's clearly talking about Daniels and Prescott's position on the daily, and the phrases that you find in F.C. Gilbert's report the day after he interviewed with Ellen White are almost identical to what Sister White herself says about the daily in Daniels and Prescott. So for many, many years before manuscript releases come out, there's no concrete testimony to refute Daniel's position. But when it comes out, it totally upholds F.C. Gilbert's position. And yet today we're not seeing our leaders refute this, because in the controversy that raged about the Daily from 1900 to 1915, Sister White was basically taking the position, let's just keep quiet on this. And the reason for it was two of the men in Adventism wanted to push this false view, and nobody else. So today, those people that want to continue to uphold this false view, they go back to Sister White's statement and say, hey, the Daily is not a test question. She said that. And she says that we're not supposed to agitate this subject, and that's true. But something's reversed today. What's reversed today is that the true position of the Daily is now in the minority. And virtually all of the majority has the false position. And if that's all that was involved, then maybe her counsel in that regard should still stand, just let the subject drop. But today, we see that Sister White also identified the history associated with the Daily as a clue to understanding the prophecy at the end. So it's important to make sure that we're correct about what it is. And before we look at Daniel 8 in our next presentation, I want to just read some of the phrases out of F.C. Gilbert's testimony that he used the day after he interviewed with Ellen White concerning Daniels and Prescott and the Daily. He said that she said, Gilbert said that Ellen White said that this Daily thing by Daniels and Prescott was a scheme of the devil. Daniels was here to see me, and I would not see him. Sister White, according to F.C. Gilbert, refused to see Daniels, although Daniels said he interviewed her. I would not have anything to say to him about anything. About the Daily that they're trying to work up, there's nothing to it. When I was in Washington, there seemed to be something that just encased their minds, and I cannot seem to touch them. We are to have nothing to do with this subject of the Daily. I know that they would work against my message, and then the people would not think there was anything to my message. I've written to him and told him that he was showing himself not fit to be president of the General Conference, not the man to keep the presidency. If this message of the Daily were a testing message, the Lord would have shown me. These people do not see the end from the beginning of this thing. I utterly refuse to see any of them who are engaged in this work. The light that was given me of God is that Brothers Daniels has stood in the presidency long enough, and I was told not to leave him, have any more conversations with him about any of these things. I would not see Daniels about this matter. I would not have one word with him. They pled with me that I would give him an interview, but I would not give him any at all. I was told to warn our people not to have anything to do with this thing they are teaching. I was forbidden of the Lord to listen to it. I've expressed myself as not having any particle of confidence in it. This whole thing they are doing is a scheme of the devil. Now that's just snippets out of what F.C. Gilbert wrote that Ellen White had told him the day before concerning Daniels and Prescott and the Daily. And this was ignored in Adventist history concerning the subject of the Daily. And we're going to close this presentation by looking at this manuscript that came out when manuscript releases began to be published. And it came out by the context of it in the 1910 time period. And you'll see that the focus of this letter was the Daily, and Prescott, and Daniels, and you'll see that Sister White clearly says their position, and their position is that it's the work that Christ is doing in the sanctuary. You'll clearly see that she says that's a scheme of the devil. But you'll also hear the echo from F.C. Gilbert's testimony. He was given an accurate testimony, and it was overlooked, ignored, buried away. At this stage of our experience, we are not to have our minds drawn away from the special light given us to consider at the important gathering of our conference. And there was Brother Daniels, whose mind the enemy was working, and your mind and Elder Prescott's mind were being worked by the angels that were expelled from heaven. Satan's work was to divert your minds that jots and tittles should be brought in which the Lord did not inspire you to bring in. They were not essential. But this meant much to the cause of truth. And the ideas of your minds, if you could be drawn away to jots and tittle, is a work of Satan's devising. to correct little things in the books written, you suppose would be doing a great work, but I am charged, silence is eloquence. And she's speaking about their desire to go back into the pioneer books and change what they said about the daily. Continuing on. I am to say, stop your picking flaws. If this purpose of the devil could only be carried out, then it appears that your work would be considered as most wonderful in conception. It was the enemy's plan to get all the supposed objectionable features where all classes of mind did not agree. And what then? The very work that pleases the devil would come to pass. There would be a representation given to the outsiders not of our faith, just what would suit them, that would develop traits of character which would cause great confusion and occupy the golden moments which should be used zealously to bring the great message before the people. The presentations upon any subject we have worked could not all harmonize, and the result would be to confuse the minds of believers and unbelievers. This is the very thing that Satan had planned that should take place. Anything that could be magnified as a disagreement. As I was shown from the first that the Lord had given neither Elder Daniels nor Prescott the burden of this work, should Satan's wiles be brought in, should this daily be such a great matter as to be brought in to confuse minds and hinder the advancement of the work at this important period of time, it should not, whatever may be. This subject should not be introduced, for the spirit that would be brought in would be forbidding, and Lucifer is watching every movement. Satanic agencies would commence his work, and there would be confusion brought into our ranks. You have no call to hunt up the difference of opinion that is not a testing question, but your silence is eloquence. I have the matter all plainly before me. If the devil could involve any one of our people on these subjects, as he has proposed to do, Satan's cause would triumph. Now the work, without delay, is to be taken up, and not a difference of opinion expressed. She's telling him to shut up on the daily. It's a scheme of the devil. Now, when I saw how you were working, my mind took in the whole situation and the result if you should go forward and give the parties that have left us the least chance to bring confusion into our ranks. Your lack of wisdom would be just what Satan would have it. Your loud proclamation was not under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. I was instructed to say to you that your picking flaws in the writings of men that God have been led of God is not inspired of God. And if this is the wisdom that Elder Daniels would give to the people, by no means give him an official position, for he cannot reason from cause to effect. Your silence on this subject is your wisdom. Now everything like picking flaws in the publications of men who are not alive is not the work God has given any of you to do. For if these men, Elder Daniels and Prescott, had followed the directions given in working the cities, there would have been many, very many, convinced of the truth and converted, able men that are now in positions where they never will be reached. She's rebuking them for not just going to work and giving the message in the cities, when all they want to do is go back in and straighten out the pioneer writings, which Sister White had confidence in. All the world is to be regarded as one great family, and when you have such a fountain of knowledge to draw from, why have you left the world to perish for years with the testimonies given by our Lord Jesus Christ? True religion teaches us to regard every man and woman as a person to whom we can do good. You can understand the way of the Lord. I saw your purpose of carrying things after your own devising after you were placed as president. You had thought you would do wonderful things, which would be a work God had not placed in your hands to do. Now your work is not to oppress, but to release every necessity possible if the Lord has accepted you to serve. But you have very early given evidence that wisdom and sanctified judgment have not been manifested by you. You blazed out matters that would not be received unless the Lord should give light. I have been instructed that such hasty movements should not have been made, such as selecting you as president of the conference even another year. But the Lord forbids any more such hasty transactions until the matter is brought before the Lord in prayer, and as you have had the message come to you that the work of the Lord resting upon the president is a most solemn responsibility, you had no moral right to blaze out as you did upon the subject of the daily and suppose your influence would decide the question. There was Elder Haskell, who has carried the heavy responsibility, And there is Elder Irwin and several men I might mention who have the heavy responsibilities. Where was your respect for the men of age? What authority could you exercise without taking all the responsible men to weigh the matter? But let us now investigate the matter. We must now reconsider whether it is the Lord's judgment in the face of the work that has been neglected of showing your zeal to carry the work even another year. If you should carry the work another year with the help that shall unite with you, there should be a change take place in you and Elder Prescott, and humble your hearts before God. The Lord will have to see you in a showing a different experience, for if ever men needed to be reconverted at this present time, it is Elders Daniel and Elders Prescott. Christ is not dead. He will never suffer his work to be carried on in this strange way. Let the books alone. If any change is essential, God will have the harmony in that change consistent. But when a message has been entrusted to men with the large responsibilities involved, God demands faithfulness that will work by love and purify the soul. Elders Daniels and Prescott both need reconversion. A strange work has come in, and it is not in harmony with the work Christ came to our world to do. Yes, I'm dropping down. Yes, it would. But while their minds were thus absorbed, I was shown that brothers Daniel and brothers Prescott were weaving into their experience sentiments of a spiritualistic appearance and drawing our people to beautiful sentiments that would deceive, if possible, the very elect. I have to trace with my pen the fact that these brethren would see defects in their delusive ideas that would place the truth in an uncertainty, and yet they would stand out as if they had great spiritual discernments. Now I am to tell them that when I was shown this matter, when Elder Daniels was lifting up his voice like a trumpet and advocating his ideas of the daily, the after results were presented. Our people were becoming confused. I saw the result, and then there was given me cautions that if Elder Daniels, without respect to the outcome, should thus be impressed and let himself believe he was under the inspiration of God, skepticism would be shown among our ranks everywhere, and we should be where Satan would carry his messages. Set unbelief and skepticism would be sown in human minds, and strange crops of evil would take the place of truth. Brothers and sisters, Sister White did not endorse Daniels and Prescott's new view of the daily being Christ's work in the sanctuary. She endorsed the position of William Miller. And she didn't sit idly by and not oppose these men. She said that Daniel shouldn't be General Conference president another day longer. That he was being led by angels that had fallen from heaven. That this new view would bring in confusion and darkness. As we consider what the daily symbolizes in the book of Daniel, the history that it's related to, we see the importance of understanding it correctly if we're going to use that history as a pattern towards the end. And in our next study, we're going to continue to uphold the pioneer position, and we're going to look at Daniel 8 and Daniel 12 and see that their understanding, the pioneer understanding, the true understanding, is sound, and it's an understanding that brings into question many of the prophetic teachings that are going on in Adventism today, because the pioneers clearly understood that the time prophecies of Daniel 12 were fulfilled, that they were already come to completement in 1798 and in 1843 and 1844. This eliminates the ease, at least, of taking these time prophecies and saying they're going to be reapplied at the end of the world a day for a day. But this does agree with where Sister White's testimony in relation to the daily, that we should never have another message hung on time. And it also identifies the correct view of the daily, a history that we would suggest to you is being repeated in our day. Because the history of the daily and its relationship to the abomination of desolation is the history of the first time the papacy came to control the world. And Sister White says it's a history that scenes similar to this will be repeated, and the scenes that will be repeated is nothing more than the second time that the papacy is going to come to control the world. And without knowing that history to use as an example, we're in danger of not recognizing that this final time that the papacy is taking the world captive is underway. It's happening today. And brothers and sisters, as the only people raised up to clarify these issues for the world, we must awaken to the truth that these end time scenes are underway if we're going to be among those that give this final warning cry. And one of the most fundamental prophetic symbols to bring this information together is the correct understanding of the daily being paganism in the book of Daniel. And we would encourage you to come back to our next study as we look at Daniel 8 more in depth.